Hello, I'm Ross Carriage, and welcome to How This Is Building Me, a podcast focused on the highs and lows, ups and downs of all those involved with cancer, cancer medicine, and cancer science across the full spectrum of life's experiences. And my guest today is someone I've known for a long time, and he's a real treat. So my guest is Dr. Ken Culver. Ken, would you care to introduce yourself in any way you see fit?
Thank you, Ross. It's a privilege to be a part of this. I know each of your guests always struggles with this question because life is complex, and I just turned 70 a couple of weeks ago, so there's a lot of history in that. I would say the things that characterize me or are primarily a person who's trying to be in service to creating a better world and a better quality of medicine and care for people around the world. And that's why I went into medicine, and I've had my wife and my children have been a part of that mission throughout the time. So it's really been a family event. So, because as everybody I'm sure you interview knows, you know, balancing your family life with your work life can be tough. So I've tried my best to merge them in every way I can to try to at least create some quality parenting time as best I can amongst the busyness of life. So my current position, you know, Ross, it's really a privilege to talk about this because it feels like my whole career has been preparing me for my current position. I'm currently the Director of Research and Clinical Affairs for an amazing patient organization called Out Positive Incorporated. I call it a patient organization, not a patient advocacy organization, because it's unique in that it's run by stage four lung cancer patients with a few caregivers. It's funded by patients. It was created by patients. And we're doing research on our own because we have so many patients that have amazing backgrounds in science and medicine and finances. So it's a privilege. My role is to work with them, the patients, to try to increase the number of treatment opportunities for our patient population. And that means that basically we're advocating with companies, universities around the globe to try to help them understand the unmet need for ALK-positive lung cancer and how they can make money if they actually develop drugs for our patient population.
I love the way you suddenly switch into their language. Let's dig into 70 years of Ken Culver. So where were you born and where were you brought up?
My dad was in the Air Force during the Korean War. I was born in Florida, but both my parents came from a farming community in Iowa called Boone, Iowa. So I was born in Florida, and then we moved to Boone, Iowa for a few years, and then from there to Des Moines, Iowa, where I grew up. One of the great things about growing up in Iowa, and I think maybe in Des Moines in particular, is it isn't just your parents raising you. There's a community around you that cares about the success of people in the community. And my story captures some of that. So I grew up in Iowa. When I was applying to colleges, I applied only to two colleges, Drake University and Iowa State. I got into both, but I went to Drake because I could live at home and save money. So I lived at home during my 4 years of college.
Is Drake in Des Moines?
It is. And then when I went to medical school, I applied to three or four, a couple in Chicago, Wash U, and Iowa. And as soon as I got into Iowa, I accepted that because the tuition was only $1,200.
Wow.
Year. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. And you know what? Halfway through, they said, sorry, we're going to have a tuition increase. It went to $1,400.
Oh, my goodness. Break the bank.
So that really, you know, the state of Iowa was very, very generous about trying to encourage and keep kids in medical school who would stay in Iowa and practice primary care with their population.
Let's flesh out the childhood a wee bit more. So how many Culvers were there in your generation? You were an only child or you had brothers?
No, I had a younger sister who was the smarty pants in the family, and I had a younger brother who was the nice one. So then, and then there was me. Yeah.
So you were the dumb, nasty one? Yeah, I'm going to beg to differ.
Well, you know, when when I was young, I never even planned to go to college. I just loved sports. So I was on the varsity football team, although I think I was probably the worst one on the starting team. I was the captain of the wrestling team. I was better there. I was on the track team. I worked at the YMCA, so I was competing in racquetball, handball, and squash. I just lived to exercise and compete in different sports. And, you know, it wasn't until I was about a senior in high school where my mom said, you know, you need to go to college. And I said, well, Mom, we don't have any money for college. She said, I'll find it. And through heroic effort, she found me scholarships and loans that allowed me to go to college. So, yeah. And then one of my mom's boss, she was a secretary at the YMCA, making about $10,000 a year supporting our family. And he was a professor at Drake. And so he sort of took me under my wing and introduced me to college. Remember those old days, Ross? There was a book you got from the university that you read through that told you all the classes and majors.
Yeah, yeah.
So he brought me to his house and he sat down and he went through all of that. And he said, I really think you should go to Drake and here are the reasons why. And he said, I think you should be pre-med. And
well, he thought that from the get-go.
He did. But I said, I said yes, only to make him happy. And so the first day I got to college, I changed to undecided. I don't know how often that happens, but you sort of have to find your purpose in life, right? So I tried business. That was boring. I tried education. That was scary. And then I thought, oh, I'm good at math and science. So I prayed a lot about going to medical school. And so that turned out to have been a really great path for me.
And then so you already said what your mom did for a living. Your dad is not big in the picture from what you've just described.
Well, he was a blue collar worker. He had a lot of different jobs. But my mom was the connection to the YMCA that gave me this larger community that, in fact, one of the things I didn't learn till much later, when I applied to medical school at the University of Iowa and I was accepted, a guy came to me and he gave me a copy of a letter that he'd sent to the dean at the University of Iowa College of Medicine. It turned out, and he'd been a long time, his kids were the age of my kids, but we'd known each other because we were camp counselors together. He was actually the president of the Iowa Medical Society and knew the dean very well. And he wrote this really nice letter to the dean about why I should get into medicine, you know.
Wow.
How, you know, getting medical school is highly competitive, right?
It's not what you know, it's who you know.
Exactly. And I had no idea in the background that there were other people who were advocating. And that was, I think, that can happen anywhere, of course, but I really felt like Iowa had a community about them, at least when I was growing up, that allowed those things to happen.
That's awesome. Mm-hmm. And so you did the medical training at Iowa University, is that right? And then you graduate, and what do you decide to do? Do you have any, are you more decided at this point in terms of what you want to be?
You know, one of the nice things about it is I went into it as sort of as a blank slate. So I kind of characterize it this way, Ross. I think there are two parts to how this happened. One is the great old Yogi Berra quote, if you don't know where you're going, you'll end up someplace else.
Yeah.
And that characterized a lot of me. And then the second part was I was brought up in a Christian family with the Christian faith. So I had confidence that whichever where I went, whatever I ended up would be the right place for me. So I kind of went into medical school with those sort of two perspectives. Like I never expected to be here, but I should be here. And so I went through my third year rotations. And when I was in surgery, I thought, they don't treat the surgery interns well. No. I don't want to go through that.
Yeah.
And I was toying between OBGYN and pediatrics. And when I was in pediatrics was my last rotation of the third year. And we're in there and I'm delivering a baby. And then as soon as I deliver a baby, I give it to the pediatrician. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. I'm interested in babies. Why would I be an obstetrician when I'm just handing them over to the pediatrician? So that had a lot to do with why I picked pediatrics. Plus, I'd been a camp counselor for about 10 years, so I really had an affinity for children. So I became a pediatrician, and then I was thinking, well, where do I want to do my residency? And I could have stayed at the University of Iowa, and it would have been great. But my plan at that point, Ross, was to go train and then come back to Iowa and be a community pediatrician and take care of kids.
Yeah.
I thought to myself, well, if I'm going to do that, I need to be able to take care of every single thing that could go wrong with the kid. So I then planned, well, my residency interviews were at Baylor at Houston, Ben Taub, for example, UC San Diego, UCSF, Stanford, UT Southwestern, maybe a couple more in there.
I love the fact you're gonna. Here we are, decades later, and you can remember the list of places that you interviewed at. That's actually
Incredible. Well, maybe that's true for everybody because they were memorable, to say the least. And when I got a call from the chairman at Ben Taub saying we want you to come here, and I got a call from UCLA saying, and so it was, which was really surprising to me because I was going to the University of Iowa. You know, it's not on the top list of, you know, who are the best. But Iowa is a great place to train and learn. And I felt like when I joined my residency at UCSF, where I finally went, and I had colleagues from all over the big name schools, I felt like, you know, my school was just as good preparing doctors for their residency as any of these others, big name. But I went to UCSF for two reasons. One is my wife said, you're going to be in the hospital all the time. I have friends there.
Okay.
And second of all, they had the city hospital, San Francisco General, and then they had the academic center. And so through that, I thought I'm going to be able to get the experience I need so that if I'm in a rural area in Iowa, I'm prepared to take care of whatever bad thing might happen.
That's cool. So let me go back a bit. So the YMCA has played a big role because I think you met your wife there too. And it sounds like you got married relatively early in your medical training. So tell us a little bit about how you met your wife.
Yeah. So the summer camp I worked at for just about 10 years it was a really cool place. We had 1 week where we only had deaf kids. And we had 1 week where we only had kids with muscular dystrophy and adults in that week. We had a week where we had kids just with diabetes. We had a week when we had kids that had, you know, mental disabilities. And then plus we had weeks where kids came that didn't have any of those. And my wife was a nursing student at the University of Iowa, and she came down to help with the kids during the week of diabetic camp. So I met her then. And then when I started in medical school in Iowa City, I met her my first day. When I happened to be moving into my apartment. So we got married at the end of my second year of medical school while she was the chief nurse at the psychiatric hospital.
Wow. And so the two of you, when did your first child arrive?
It was my graduation present on April 8th, just about 6 weeks before I graduated, and we moved to San Francisco.
Wow. And then how many kids have you got in total?
Three.
One boy and two girls?
Two boys, and then the girl is the third, yeah.
There you
great
go.
Kid, really great kids.
Okay, so let's go back to San Francisco in the timeline. Mm-hmm. So you go to San Francisco, and we're talking, what, early 80s at this
point? It was 1981.
Okay.
When I arrived, and of course, HIV was going to really hit right after. It's amazing, Ross, when I think about having gone there. So we arrived there in May or June 1981. And where we lived, you had to drive through the Castro area to get to the medical center, which was the hub of the male, gay sort of celebratory atmosphere. And you drive through there and you could hardly drive through. There were so many men on the streets, some walking just in fur jocks. I mean, it was just all open, fun time. And then just a couple of months later, you drive through there and there's nobody on the street.
Wow.
They did a really great job of educating men to say, hey, we have to change our behavior. We don't know what's going on. And yeah, so I saw culturally and, of course, scientifically and medically, a real transformation in that first year, first couple of years we lived there.
I think you told me your experience with, like, the first recorded HIV case.
In children. So in San Francisco, it was primarily in males in the gay community, but it was moving its way into the drug abusing community. I must have been a second or third year resident. So maybe 1983, roughly. We had a child come in who had severe immunodeficiency, and we didn't know what it was. And I was doing my ICU rotation, and that night at 5 o'clock when we did rounds, the attending said to me, "Ken, the CDC is flying here tomorrow to collect." We knew she was going to die from all her advanced infections. "Can you keep her alive until the morning so that they can collect it?" So, you know, I'm on call and I'm, you know, going up on the respiratory pressures, and we're up to maximum oxygen, and we're on pressors. And so I called the attending out of the middle of the night. And I said, "She's not going to make it." And he said, "Okay, well, we've dispatched the CDC there now." And that turned out to be, if not the first one, the second case of childhood HIV infection. And of course, we didn't know at that point what it was. In fact, my first research project when I was a resident, Ross, you're reminding me, is I was really interested in HIV transmission to children. So I got an IRB-approved protocol at San Francisco General to draw blood on all drug-abusing moms and their babies, to do immune function tests, and to do antibody tests for HIV. Right then, it was being called LAV, and we were using testing center by Jay Levy there at UCSF. And then, so what I did was, I think I got about 30 women enrolled. The problem I hadn't anticipated was that basically every one of these kids got placed in foster care.
Yeah.
So to do the follow-up blood draw at 6 months, I had to travel all over Northern California to foster homes and explain to them, I have a signed consent form from the mother. And what we found in the end was that none of these moms were HIV positive, but all the kids had suppressed immunity out to 6 months.
Oh.
And that the drug abuse alone was immunosuppressive for these children. Now, that's buried in some journal from 30 years ago. It's probably never referenced in anything. And you'd get in the elevator at San Francisco General, and you know, you'd have four men in there with you, and they'd all have purple patches on them. They were going up to the Carposi Sarcoma Clinic. It was a tough time.
So through the miracle of Google, whilst you've been talking, I came across the acronym GRID, Gay-Related Immunodeficiency.
Yeah, there you go. Wow.
That was what was used in the 1980s initially, because they thought it was only in the gay community, and then expanded out to IV drug abusers, and Haitians later came in, but obviously you're on the wrong coast for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, so you're going through pediatrics. At what point do you decide what aspect of pediatrics you want to specialize in and deviate away from going back to Iowa and being a community pediatrician? Because you didn't do that.
No. And it's sort of, you know, it's a gradual process, Ross, but there's like these signposts that happen that like redirect you along your way. So I was in my internship year, and I was on one of the inpatient services, and I came in one Saturday morning, and they said, "Ken, you know, your patient Gunther, he died just a short time ago." And his room was down on the end of the corridor overlooking Golden Gate Park and the Golden Gate Bridge. And I'm walking down there thinking, what am I going to say? What can I do? And he had a fatal form of kidney failure, and they weren't able to do kidney transplants back then like they can do today. And I walked in there, and I sat down, and the parents were holding him, and I just cried with him. It was a really powerful experience. And as I went through my residency at UCSF, I had way too many of those experiences where kids were coming in. They had these incurable conditions, and they would die. And so I had originally UCSF Pediatrics had two tracks. You had the primary care track and you had the research track. And I had gone there on the primary care track because I thought I'd go back to Iowa and be a pediatrician. But then I changed after the end of that first year, Russ, because of these experiences like Gunther, one after another, made me think, you know, there's got to be something better than watching these kids suffer and die. And so that's why I sort of changed my whole career towards research.
And then when did you take the big move to actually just take a pure research job?
Yeah. So when I finished my residency, my 3 years pediatric residency, I love caring for patients so much, and I still do. So I was chief resident at San Francisco General for a year, which was it wasn't a research experience, but it was
an amazing experience.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe it's same there in Denver you are, but at the San Francisco General, there were no fellows. There was one attending. There were two chief residents and then the residents. So you really needed to be on your game. You had to teach, of course, medical students, but you had to also take a lot of responsibility when you were called to the emergency room or taking care of patients. So it was a fabulous experience. And frankly, I told Dr. Grossman, the head, you know, if it was possible, I'd do a second year because it was just so meaningful. But one of the reasons I did that chief residency year is I wanted to do an immunology fellowship at UCSF, and it was every 2 years, and I needed to wait 1 year till I could get in the slot.
Wow. But
when I finished my chief residency year, then I went back to USF to do a 2-year immunology fellowship, which by and large at that time they ran the bone marrow transplant unit. And so I was a fellow in the bone marrow transplant unit where we were taking care of kids with immunodeficiency disorders, as well as kids with cancer. And back then, Ross, in those early days, you know, haploidentical transplants were sort of the norm because we didn't have everything. You know, transplant was still relatively early in its development. So it was, that again was reinforced this research position where, again, many of these kids in the bone marrow transplant unit, we do these heroic efforts and they would still die.
Didn't you tell me you were involved in like one of the first cases of gene therapy?
Yeah.
During that time?
Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting. So I was in my lab, which was right across the street from the chairman's, right across the hall from the chairman's office. And one day I stepped out of the lab and there was a guy there in a suit and he looked lost. So I said, "Hey, can I help you find something?" He said, "Oh, I'm here interviewing for a job. I'm looking for so-and-so." And I said, "Well, I'd, you know, glad to help you find the place, but where do you work?" He said, "I work at NIH." And I said, "Well, I was now thinking how I could expand my career because my fellowship was going to end." And I said, "Well, I'm interested in a job at NIH." He said, "Oh, well, if you end up coming to a job at NIH, let me know. You can stay at my house."
Wow.
But, well, this is really a good deal. So
this is the community just sort of works around you.
It is. It's a pretty cool. But it gets more amazing than that because I keep calling and writing NIH. You know, there's no internet then, so it was tough. And I finally found a guy who said he might have a position open.
Okay.
And so I schedule to fly out there at my own cost on the hope that that might open up. So I called Don, his name's Don Cohn, and I said, "Don, can I stay at your house?" And he said, "Oh, by the way, I'm leaving. You can interview for my job."
Oh my goodness.
So I went there, I interviewed for his job. They gave it to me. I bought his house and I bought his car. And on the signing the papers for the house, it turned out we had the same birthday. And I'm thinking, "Oh, this is amazing."
That's incredible.
Divine intervention, right? And when I started my job was to develop gene therapy for adenosine deaminase deficiency, a type of bubble boy disease. And that was one of the diseases that we were trying so hard to cure when I was working the bone marrow transplant at UCSF.
So it was a circle.
It was a full circle experience. And so to make a long story short, then on September 14th, 1990, about 3 months after I moved to NIH, I had the privilege of administering the first gene therapy treatment to a four-year-old girl with adenosine deaminase deficiency. She was four then. She is alive and doing well now, 39 years later.
That's incredible.
Yeah, at the age of 39. The other child we treated is doing well too.
So essentially, and then just educate me on this. So does it just look like a bone marrow transplant? When we're saying gene therapy, you're just saying there's something wrong in your bone marrow. We'll get rid of the bad stuff and then we'll put somebody else's in.
Yeah. So we were doing a very primitive form of that. It's advanced a lot now with lentiviral vectors and things. But back then we were using Mollonnay viruses, which we were putting into T cells because they only would go into proliferating cells and we couldn't really get them into stem cells. So this was really a T cell transplant that we did for these girls, and we did a number of infusions. It's published.
Was it their own cells?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, it was very rudimentary, right? So I would go with the nurses. We would take out 60 ml of blood into a big syringe, and then we would centrifuge it because she was too small to be on a normal apheresis unit at the time. We'd spin it down, we'd pull out the buffy coat, we'd reinfuse, and then we do another one until we got enough. Then we put the cells in culture, and they were starting in, you know, 24 well plates.
Hold on, I got to clarify. So you would pull out the white blood cells and then give the rest of the blood back to her so she didn't get horribly anemic?
Yeah.
And then just, okay. So like a selective extractions of cells.
Yeah. And you'll appreciate this. So, you know, one of the days we had two girls, one four and one about nine, and we were doing it on, and we would have a video playing to distract them from all the time, you know, we were doing this. And one day the girl's heart rate kept going up and getting really tachycardic, and I'm trying to figure out what it was. And then I realized the movie that they were watching, it was this, had these scary parts where someone was stealing a baby. Never, never. So it had nothing to do with our...
Well, there we go. So it's a perfect distraction.
It was really good, except I had to learn that part of it. And what's amazing about this is, so these kids being immunodeficient, they had no tonsils, they had no lymph nodes.
Okay.
And the first little girl we treated, you know, I was seeing her every couple of weeks, and she grew tonsils. And she grew some small lymph nodes in her neck. And so you could imagine those T cells that we infused were going back to lymphoid tissues, and they were creating a healthy environment. We never biopsied any, but you'd assume there probably were some B cells in there, and it was probably looking more like a normal node. So it was, from a clinical point of view and from a research point of view and from certainly a caring for patients point of view, it was like, it's been really a highlight of my whole career.
And then, you told me that you did one with glioblastoma multiforme, so a kind of brain tumor. Was that in the same attachment? Was that something else? Or is that later? Am I getting confused?
Well, so while we were doing the HIV, the ADA children's thing, I had this idea, because what we did is we used cells to produce the virus. And we were working with all kinds of different genes in these viruses. In fact, I did one study where I thought, well, if you took T cells and you expressed interferon in them, could you prevent them from being HIV infected? Because this was before we had all the cool ARVs now. And so I made a research plan with the FDA, and we took cells, I put interferon in them, and then we exposed them to HIV, and we found out it didn't work because the cells were so smart, they shut down the interferon.
Oh.
Yeah, and Steve Rosenberg did a study later on trying to express TNF in his T cells, and the same thing happened. The T cells didn't want that much. Nowadays, with inducible vectors and things, you might be able to do something completely different. So I then thought, well, what if you just took those? We then were working with a gene called the herpes simplex virus thymidine kinase gene. And what happens there is, if you put that gene into a tumor cell and treat it with an antiviral, you basically kill it, because you basically make the tumor cell vulnerable to antivirals.
Yeah.
So we took cells that produce a retrovirus with the thymidine kinase gene, and I injected them into tumors in mice, and then gave them the antiviral, and the tumors rapidly regressed. So then we did an experiment in rhesus monkeys, and then we did an experiment in rats. We published our data in Science, and basically showing that you could using this technique, you could, you know, substantially kill a tumor in the brain. So we did a clinical trial at NIH. It had about 10 patients, and we had a couple of responses. In fact, one of the guys kept in touch with me. He'd had a recurrent glioblastoma after surgery and chemotherapy, and he lived about 40 years.
Wow.
And he died just recently of unrelated to glioblastoma. Now, so they then, oddly enough, Novartis bought the company and the rights, and they did a big global trial with it, and the response rate was about 5%. So it never, and it was going to be called Gleevec. That's where the name Gleevec came from. It was going to be for this therapy.
So Gleevec from glioblastoma?
Right, and for Vector. So,
oh my goodness, that's a great piece of history.
Yeah, and so then that name then was attached to imatinib, because imatinib came along, and it was so, so it's a great name.
I imagine the issue with it is getting your kill switch, your thymidine kinase into the cancer cell. So did you have to sort of inject directly into the brain, or
yep,
a neurosurgeon did it at the time?
Yeah, the way we were doing it was injecting it in multiple locations in the tumor fossa with surgery, a centimeter deep, because when the thymidine kinase gene and GAN cyclic reenacted, it created a bystander effect.
Okay.
That we could show very, very clearly. And that hasn't really gone anywhere, but there's a lot of therapies in glioblastoma that ended up in the same place, sadly.
Yeah, I know. So I think you spent 6 years in total at the NIH.
Yeah.
Doing some really amazing groundbreaking work in these kind of relatively small but transformational studies. And then after 6 years, I think you were senior clinical investigator.
Yeah.
So why aren't you still there?
What happened? So I went to one of the senior people in NIH, and I said to them, my fellowship is ending. I'd love to stay. And he said, Ken, all the senior positions are filled. We don't expect that to change. You're better off going someplace else and waiting. But if you look now, Tom Waldman was there till after he was 80. I think Steve Rosenberg is in that same. So there.
Yeah, that's pretty bad when you kind of look above you and there's lots of people who are going to live forever. And it's like, I've always been relatively sympathetic to that, of kind of waiting for dead men's shoes to sort of go into there. And I do think, that's not right. You can't sort of block out generations just because you don't want to retire.
Yeah. And the guy who told me that then left a few months later to go to industry somewhere.
Okay.
So that was, and they were really talented guys. I mean, I can't object to the fact of that, but that was why I left. And I was thinking, all right, well, if I want to make the biggest impact for the most patients, I can go be a pediatrician and see one patient at a time. Or maybe if I go to industry, then I could help a larger population, So, and I kind of had validation of that. So when I went to Novartis, one of the earlier drugs I worked on was Zometa. And we were doing trials to try to show that Zometa created survival benefit for patients with lung cancer, myeloma. And eventually we did.
So that's a bone strengthening medication for those people.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they would show every year or whatever at our annual meeting, that Zometa has helped, 100,000 people or more. And I'm thinking, all right, well, my contribution, however small, is making a real difference for a lot of people. But I think also.
You didn't start off at Novartis though, did you?
That was my first pharma company.
I thought you had like a small biotech.
I did. I tried a couple little biotechs. In fact, that's why I went to pharma, because the biotech I went to before that, I came home from a business trip and the company was locked up and out of business.
Yeah, that is the problem with biotech.
And by that time I had three kids and I thought, so that was the other appeal of it, was that I could create some I've been sort of chasing my heart along the way from research, and I thought I need to provide some stability. My kids are getting older. And so I really stuck with pharma for a lot of years. One, because I felt like I was doing something important. Two, because it gave stability to my family. And three, because along with it, I'd gotten involved in this charity where my desire to provide patient care and make a difference for people could also be served. So it sort of was a three-part thing. It was Novartis, it was family, and it was the mission work in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah, so let's touch into that. So you get a job at Novartis. So when did, and this is what turned into Foundation for Peace.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when did that start?
So I started at Novartis in 1998, which is about 2 years after it was formed from the, Novartis was formed from Sandoz and Ciba-Geigy. So I joined about 2 years after that, and I was hired to start the clinical pharmacogenetics group. So at that point, Novartis didn't have any routine collection of blood for pharmacogenetic or mutation analysis in cancer.
So let me just try and explain what that is to the audience. So looking at things where how you and I differ in our genetics in terms of metabolizing drugs or something to do with the things that affect the levels of drug in the blood, for example.
Yeah. And so we had all these drugs in development, whether it's neurology, respiratory, transplant, oncology, and so forth. So my job, and I spent 3 years getting sample collection and consent, your proper consent forms and things into all across the whole company. And that was, you know, now that's standard. But back then, that was, it was, I had to fly all over the world to meet with IRBs to convince them that, you know, we weren't trying to take tissues from patients for cancer, but really, we're really interested in arthritis, right?
It's, yeah.
There was, and now it's, thank goodness, now it's become standard. So it was a really fast.
But there was also, I think I remember, a friend of mine who's a pathologist describing it as the third rail of research, as if you looked at genomic material, this idea that you have this database of people in some weird sci-fi, you know, version.
That's exactly how it was. And I remember I went to visit one IRB in Germany, and I pass out my card and they're passing them around. And then there's one woman in the committee who refuses to take my card and passes it the rest.
Oh my goodness.
But, you know, I gave them my pitch and then they approved the protocol the next day. So, you know, it's like so many things in our business, Ross. In the end, it becomes relationships. And so when we were able to have a conversation, then she could understand better, you know, that what our motivation and what safeguards were in place. Because, yeah, so anyway, it was a great learning experience. And I think having learned to be an advocate for maybe for patients and certainly children in the beginning really helped me with that. And it's really helping me today in my new job, is because that's, I see, one of the most important contributions I'm making is being a voice for, that was a voice for patients, not really a voice for Novartis.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
So hold on, we've got to get back to the Foundation for Peace. That's where we started. Okay. So how did it start?
Yeah.
You started off in Novartis doing pharmacogenomics, and somehow this is going to lead into Foundation for Peace. Yeah. I'm just trying to keep you honest here.
Yeah, thank you. Well, actually start slightly earlier. So I came to NIH in 1987. I went to Novartis in 1998. So you can see there's about a 10-year gap there. In 1989, I was sitting in church, and I look at the church bulletin, and it says, needed adult supervisors to go on a mission trip to the Dominican Republic. And so it was really tough for me to decide what to do, because, Ross, my research, I was putting, at that point, I was putting genes for growth hormone in different tissue types and showing how growth hormone could be produced. And I got an opportunity to present my research in Europe. I'd never been to Europe, but I said, oh, this is more important. So I canceled. I decided to go to the Dominican Republic, and we went there. And I asked the leader of the group, was a group of teenagers from the church, could I meet with some missionary doctors and understand the practice of medicine in the Dominican Republic while I'm there? So they got these two doctors, a husband and wife, and they took me out to their clinic each morning, and I brought a couple of the teenagers along from the team. And it was such a powerful experience to see the need and how you could make a real difference in people who really had little or no access to healthcare, that basically I never stopped going. So I've been going down there for about 35, 36 years now, every year. And we expanded to Haiti in 2006 and then to Kenya in 2007. And before COVID, we were getting close to 1,000 volunteers a year, about half medical and half from churches or public schools. And then, of course, COVID brought it to zero, and now we're gradually rebuilding. So we're giving nursing students, nursing faculty, medical students, medical faculty, physician assistants, students and faculty a chance to come down and spend a week and learn cross-cultural medicine and provide care for people who otherwise don't get any.
But when do you go from saying, I came down and I visited and, you know, I got something useful out of it and I gave something to this community, to I'm going to create my own foundation?
Yeah. So that really happened when I took my Novartis job, because when I was in D.C., I could work with my local church. But once I moved to New Jersey to work for Novartis, I didn't have a church. I didn't have a community. So the idea was then to create a nonprofit organization. And just by telling people about what we were doing and why, we grew. I think in 2000, we had 18, the next year, 37, then 57, then 97. We had a really nice growth because, you know, there are a lot of people out there who really want to do this kind of thing if they knew they had opportunity and people they could trust who would give them a meaningful experience. So we've had over 10,000 people now who've gone, but I had never intended. In fact, my wife had said to me, Ken, why do you want to create another organization? Aren't there already out there? So now we had internet. So I searched around and I realized that what makes our organization a little bit different is for many of our medical teams, they do medical, but they might also do one day of construction, one day of building something, right? They'll go to an optional church service where they're seeing patients because, you know, our patients, you know, they're not just physical, they're also mental and they're also spiritual beings, right? So we try to show them how we're trying to serve the whole person. And whether it's a public university or whether it's a church, we try, you know, we're very sensitive and we have different programs, but we want people, when they leave, to feel like they've made a difference, and two, that they're going to be a better healthcare provider now that they've had this experience.
Yeah. And do some of them come back and work there a long time? Because they're in a good, a week at a time.
100%. Yeah. 100%. And in fact, now we bought the property next to our headquarters in Santo Domingo. We're making it into what we're calling a health and wellness center. And that my idea is they can stay at our headquarters and during the day, medical students or physicians can go next door. I mean, you think about the we've got a real crisis now in the Dominican Republic, Ross, because Haitians are coming in by the thousands every day because of the gang activity and the insecurity of Haiti. And so they're coming in and they're living on the margins of the Dominican communities. The Dominican Republic just enacted a rule that says any undocumented Haitian who goes to a Dominican facility for medical care must be treated and then immediately deported.
Oh, wow. It's a similar message in many countries.
Yes, and ours including here too. And so this is a big deal now. So how do we change what we do to provide care for those patients in those margins used to be before, you know, if they needed surgery, we could send them to the Dominican hospital if they needed some specialized medicine. So we're now figuring out how can we pivot, and we're going to care for Dominicans too. It's not just about Haitians, but it's a tragic situation. Whether people are in Haiti or on these margins, they're really struggling.
So you essentially create a foundation that sounds like an enormous amount of work and responsibility whilst you have a full-time job at Novartis. So how does it, how many times a year do you go down to the Dominican Republic?
Four or five.
Okay. But who's running it when you're not there?
Yeah. Well, fortunately, we've got really great dedicated people. So the Dominican Republic, we have four full-time staff in the Dominican Republic, 120 years, 215 years. We've got really dedicated people. And then here in the U.S., my wife and two or three other people manage sort of organizing all the teams that will go down. So I handle finances, the accounting, the taxes, the overall sort of supervision. But I will say, Ross, that a woman came up, we were in at one of the Novartis office buildings, and I made some presentations at Novartis, and we had a lot of Novartis people come, vice presidents and people more junior. Over the years, it was great to have colleagues come and serve together. When she came up to me and at the elevator, we were waiting, and she said, "Ken, I know why you go to the Dominican Republic." She said, "It keeps you sane."
Yeah.
So I thought in some small way that might have been exactly why I kept doing it.
Yeah, I can totally see that. So you're in industry which has its own set of, you know, agendas and everything else, and then you have this kind of force that's really just for good. I mean, there's no other agenda.
Right. And so, yeah, I always said, you know, my job, a foundation for peace, is me to give them money. I don't get paid anything to do this. And I'm fine with that. But that's exactly how it worked, how it continues to work. So now we're up to maybe over 300, and we're having a really nice growth in nursing and medical students who are coming, who are having really powerful experiences, Ross. So I'm hoping, you know, when they're back, you know, for cross-cultural experiences, a minimum, and or in resource, if they're in resource-deprived areas, you know, they have sort of an appreciation that they can make a difference.
Whilst you're at Novartis, and we said you started off in pharmacogenomics, but how long were you at Novartis in total?
I was there 20 years.
Well, and that's pretty impressive too. I mean, I guess unlike, you know, we said biotech is kind of like, you know, here today, gone tomorrow. But your stability at Novartis, there's some churn in pharma too. So, yeah, I think when I first got to know you, you were a constant, you know, you were there. But obviously, by the time I got to know you, you weren't in pharmacogenomics. So how did you transition within the company?
Yeah. So in pharmacogenomics, after about 3 years, we really had made so much progress in incorporating sample collection and everything. It's sort of getting kind of like a little boring. So at that point, Novartis decided to create the oncology business unit, as opposed they would have its own profit and loss. And so even though I've been working in oncology during my pharmacogenetics, I moved to formally into oncology, and my role there was called translational medicine. And so we were doubling down on collect tumor samples and analyzing them. So when I joined oncology, I went to the senior vice president, David Parkinson, said, "Hey, David, I knew what could I do that would be a good learning experience for me?" He said, "Oh, well, this weekend there's an investigator meeting for imatinib. Why don't you go to that?" So I go down to the meeting, and I'm there with the three leaders, and it's the first time the phase one data with imatinib is ever shown, and it shows the complete elimination of the cells in CML. And then, of course, Gleevec went on to be just a fantastic drug.
And it was like the first targeted therapy, really.
Exactly. And it was good. It was great. And that actually had so many positive effects. And one of the positive effects it had that helped me stay at Novartis was people realized that if you have a good drug, you're going to make money. So it's not about making money. It's about making good drugs. And so I worked, I didn't work specifically on Gleevec, but I learned from it. And then I worked on Zometa. And then I worked on Femara, which was a really great aromatase inhibitor, which showed overall survival benefit in postmenopausal women. So Meta showed overall survival benefit in a subset of multiple myeloma. So I was in translational medicine, but I left that apart. Then I moved to the phase one group. And for 6 years, I was in the phase one group. And what a different experience that is compared to working with these marketed compounds.
Yeah, so that's like the first time the drug is tried out in people.
Yeah, exactly. And you're trying to figure out the dose, and you're gradually increasing the dose, and you're having meetings every couple of weeks to decide what to do. And some of our drugs did really great. And some of our drugs, we could never figure out a proper dose, and they had to be discontinued. It was really scientifically, clinically, a really fascinating part of the company. And then I made the transition to medical affairs. And I saw parts of pharma I'd never knew existed. Like, I didn't know there were even MSLs when I was in the phase one group.
Medical science liaisons, yeah, for those. So, yeah, the guys who go out and, you know, speak to people like me.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. They talk to you to help you make sure you know what Novartis is doing and what, you know, and the data and so forth. And I didn't know commercials. And now, well, I did know commercial, but I saw them in a new way. So medical affairs just fit perfectly with me because it allowed me to interact with people like you to learn and to talk about what was going on and what could we do together that's going to bring something better for patients. And so I did about the last 8 or 10 years of that. And what was nice about that was my profile, because ceritinib came into my portfolio, which was the second ALK drug and the first and only one Novartis made. I got to know the lung cancer community. And from there, then I got to be the U.S. lead for the BRAF inhibitor and the U.S. lead for capmatinib. And so I really got to know the lung cancer community and appreciate the men and women and how well they worked together and how they wanted to make a difference for our patients with lung cancer. So I became the U.S. strategy lead for all the products being tested in lung cancer at Novartis. And I really, really enjoyed that. Yeah.
It's funny. I've interviewed somebody else from medical affairs, somebody from AstraZeneca called Ilke Oslin. And he's actually has a lot of similarities with you. You know, he's Turkish, and then he sort of did Médecins Sans Frontières. And again, I think medical affairs maybe, you know, based on my sample size of two, is attracting these people with a kind of global vision to try and change things for the better. It's kind of cool. When you finished up at Novartis, were you planning on just retiring?
Yes.
Or did you always plan to sort of, you know, have a second career, third career, whatever we're after?
That's a really good point. So, yeah, every company goes through its ups and downs culturally. And I'd gone through a lot of those with Novartis. And when I got to 2022 or 2018, I was 63. And I thought to myself, well, if I'm ever going to do something different, now's the time to do it. So I, instead of retiring immediately, I spoke to my children and I decided to go to GSK to work on cell therapy, because cell therapy is where I'd sort of started my career at NIH. And I thought that would be a good way to end it. And I was at,
you're like bookends to your career. I like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So I was there for 4 years. And at the end of the 4 years, the company decided to discontinue those cell therapy works. That meant the 500 people who were working on the project all needed to find jobs. So there I decided, okay, I'm really going to retire.
Okay.
So I go to ASCO 2022, walking through there thinking, oh, this is the last time, you know, I've been going there for 30 years. Yeah. I see my friends and learn. And then I get two job offers. One to be a vice president of a biotech, and another one to join out positive.
And that was through a Novartis connection, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. One of the MSLs that I met, his daughter had developed ALK-positive lung cancer, and they were looking for a lead for their research. And so Ray, I have a lot of respect for Ray. And so I met with, at ASCO, I met with the CEO and one of the patients, and I guess the rest is history. It's been one of the best things I could have ever done in my life.
So the Ray's daughter, Summer, I actually interviewed on this thing. So she has a podcast where we talk about her role as a patient advocate. But this position that you took on in ALK Positive, it hadn't existed before. You weren't replacing someone. So it's, again, it's like, Ken, here's a blank slate.
And that's been really nice. And I think that's been a win-win for the organization, because I didn't know what I could provide and they didn't know what I could provide. And what we found was really quickly, Ross, is that the group of patients had organized themselves and they could make a really great case for why someone should, from a patient point of view, the unmet need for outpatients and why someone should be developing drugs for them.
Okay.
But what I know coming from pharma, that that's nice, but then the next half hour you're talking to the Pancreatic Association and the next half hour you're talking to the glioblastoma. So you need more than that. So what we did when I joined in 2022 is the first thing we did was we created a business case. How can companies make money now?
Yeah.
We created a science and a medical case. You know, what's the justification? Why might your drug succeed? And that's really helped us to get a lot more interest. So putting the patient advocacy with the business and the medicine. And I think that was something neither of us really realized that was going to be sort of a win-win that would come out of this work.
So what are you, I mean, these things take time. So you've been there 2.5, 3 years. What are the successes from your perspective?
Mm-hmm.
Or what is about to become a success will allow you a sort of future perspective too?
Yeah. Well, so one of them is that when I joined, they were giving grants, and almost all their grants were for early discovery. And I said to them, you know, we really need to have a balanced portfolio. It's good to have discovery, but you need translational, but you also need clinical trials, because the people who are on the calls with me are living for years. And so if we do something more near term, what they're funding, what they're agreeing to can help them as individuals.
Yeah.
But now we've got a much more balanced portfolio of the things we're funding. And I think that that is a huge win. The second thing is we've been able to talk to a number of biotech companies and get them to have their drugs tested in ALK models.
Okay.
And so working, you know, not just with the University of Michigan, but in part with them, a number of NTAs, the University of Michigan has been testing them and their ALK models as a to help develop whether or not this should go into clinics. And that started before I got there. The next thing is we've been able to talk to companies and be able to give them our business case, our science case, and our patient case, where looks like Regeneron is going to add an ALK arm to one of their trials. Immunity Bio is going to add an arm. The company you spoke with, Triana, ALK is now their first target, and they hopefully for next year. And then Christine Lovely's been advocating for us with Nuvectis and others. And then we also have been doing some internal research looking at RNA expression. And that supported the BioNTech is starting up a vaccine trial at MD Anderson. And part of the reason why is the data that we generated. So I would say one of our biggest wins is there are about 6 trials that are going to be starting in these next few months that would have never happened if it hadn't been for our ALK advocacy.
And clinical trials are very expensive. And no matter how good your philanthropy is, it's hard to, you know, have the muscle of one of these companies that's for profit. So it sounds like, is it a partnership? How much do you contribute the money to clinical trials, and how much it's kind of like, I'm just going to, you know, make the case and hope that someone else takes it over and runs the clinical
trial? Yeah. And of course, that's always the line, right? So when we were talking with our patients, you know, they would like to spend as little bit of money as possible and spread it as wide as possible. which I'm agreed. But I said, to the extent that that slows things down, it doesn't work to our best interest. So for things like Immunity Bio and the BioNTech trial at MD Anderson, the Nuvectis trial, those are company funded. But for other things like putting a HER2 inhibitor with lorlatinib, and then David Carbone's been working on this Wnt inhibitor that they have in EGFR, and they want to, you know, we're paying for preclinical data to see if it works in ALK, and it looks like it may actually be better in ALK. We're going to pay the per patient costs. The company will provide the drug. So at our summit, which comes up in just a couple of days, I'm letting everybody know that, you know, the per patient cost to do these trials could be $20,000 to $50,000 a patient, and that we need. So last year, we have an amazing leadership at ALK Positive. Last year, they raised $3.5 million.
Wow.
Our goal this next year is $5 million. And so the budget that I have includes a certain amount already allocated for per patient cost to start 4 trials.
How do you deal with the fact that your employers, for want of a better term, are all people with a terminal disease, you know, let's call a spade a spade here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they will have an agenda that no matter how much they try and be objective is driven by their own personal need. Mm-hmm. So how do you square that circle where somebody's like, I need something now. And you're going, but, you know, my balanced portfolio suggests that, you know, we're investing for the future too.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly true, Ross. So we'll take a couple of examples for that. So if we're working on a trial with a company and they want to go specifically in lorlatinib failures, first line lorlatinib failures, for example,
yeah,
the patients on the committee who are on first line lorlatinib will say, wait a minute.
Yeah.
That, right. And, you know, depending on the situation, you know, we talk to companies and I tell them straight up, hey, I got patients here and here, and I want to be able to give them all an opportunity. So in some cases, we'll say, all right, we're going to start here. And if we see activity, we're going to pivot to there. The other one that's really, I think, characteristic of our patient group is we're working on, as you know, the ALK vaccine is a part of the Breakthrough Cancer Group. And the first trial is most likely going to be HLA restricted.
Yeah.
So I'll have patients who say to me, Ken, my HLA doesn't match that. This won't work for me. How are we going to deal with that? Right. So then I talk to BTC and our plan is, yes, we're going to start with HLA-A2, but if it works and expands, then we're going to include everybody. So the way I'm handling that is trying to make sure that a realistic is going to evolve, you know, of course, being on the data, so that everybody gets there, has an opportunity.
So I like that because it still stays scientific. So one of my experiences with other patient advocacy groups is their major goal is to make all trials eligible to all of their clientele, even though it's blatantly not going to work. Mm-hmm. And for me, I'm sympathetic to the need to provide hope, but it's false hope. And so I do think you have to stay scientifically rigorous and not just be, you know, I'm just selling hope.
Yeah. And the other part of that is that I say with our group, and this comes from being in pharma, is I'm saying, look, they can't get this drug on the market if they do all that. If they focus on this and they show activity, that's going to get them a pathway to getting FDA approved. And that's what we really need for these drugs, because that, you know, expands access. So I think they realize that sort of the order at which we do things, there are multiple contributing factors, and patient concerns is one of them, an important one, but it's not the only one.
Yeah. I mean, I think your objectivity and your history in pharma has really sort of taken patient organization to a different level. And I suspect it'll be a model that will be replicated, hopefully, by other patient advocacy groups. But that leads me to, of course, the big question of here you are, you're 70 years old. We're on career number 75 or whatever it is. What are the next few years going to bring? What do you want me to bring?
So my hope is by the next 2 years that we'll start a dozen trials, at least a third of those as immunotherapy trials. That's the other thing, Ross, that's been really frustrating to me in the community is that, you know, we out positive are being excluded from a lot of the immunotherapy trials just because we didn't respond to single agent Nevo or Pembro. So we're really trying to say, hey, you know, there's 60, 70 some checkpoints out there. Just because one doesn't work doesn't mean others won't. So we're really, that's where my goal is, starting trials and enrolling them quickly. That's the other big thing we're focusing on, that if we as an organization say we want this trial and companies put it up, that we're going to roll it quickly, because if we don't, then we've squandered the opportunity.
Your patient clientele have to step up to the plate too, obviously, when it's appropriate for them.
Exactly. And that's, and because of the Facebook group, and I'm not a member since I'm not a patient, but from what they tell me is there are quite a few patients who, when they progress, are talking about it on the Facebook. So we've got a way to really let people know, hey, there are trials here and there for you to consider. Actually, we're putting up a tool on our website. It's a clinical trial finding tool. Again, trying to make it easier, and we're trying to encourage patients to use that tool and find out what's available, be familiar with it before they have a progression. Instead of being this fire drill when all of a sudden, you know, their tumor's growing.
I do. I mean, I've always felt as a clinician that you want to have your plan B ready long before you need it. And occasionally you change your plan B and, you know, in the heat of the moment, but you got to have one.
Yeah, you got to have one.
You don't suddenly start, okay, I'll think about it on the day I progress.
Exactly. And even beyond clinical trials, we want them to say, all right, well, if I progress, who am I going to go to for a second opinion? Have that already planned. And you may not go, but you know, depends on where you start.
I think you've had an amazing life so far, and I hope it continues.
Me too.
And thanks for sharing your story with us.
Ross, it's a privilege. No one's ever asked me these questions before, so it's been fun for me to think through them and reminisce about them. Thank you.
You've been listening to How This Is Building Me with host me, D. Ross Camage. Rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on @DrCamage on Blue Sky for additional commentary.